This past month, we've been reflecting on the major events in the life of the Buddha, his birth, his enlightenment, and his passing away. So tonight, I thought we could listen to part of a sutta that talks a little bit more about this knowledge that the Buddha gained on the night of his enlightenment. So the sutta that we'll listen to part of tonight is called the Mahasihanada Sutta. It's in the collection of middle-length discourses. So the word maha is a very common word, especially in titles of discourses. So does anybody know what maha means?
Great.
Yeah, it means great, exactly. Like Maharaja, so the great king. Maharaja. So many discourses have the word Maha in front of them, either because they themselves are just very large, or to contrast them with a discourse with a similar name that's not great, that's not as large. So Maha can mean great in terms of good, but also large is usually So, Mahasihanada. So, Siha is a lion in Pali, and Nada is sound. So, Mahasihanada is the great sound of a lion, which is a roar. Lions make roars. So, it's called the Greater Discourse on the Lion's Roar. So, maybe you've heard that often the Buddha is described as a lion. In fact, in the logo of our monastery, you'll see two lions supporting a Dhamma wheel. So this idea of a lion's roar, it's a discourse where either the Buddha or one of his disciples makes a great declaration about their enlightenment and the things that they've achieved with their enlightenment, or simply the excellent qualities of the Buddha. So in the shorter discourse on the lion's roar, the Buddha explains why disciples of the Buddha can rightly praise him. And in the Mahasihanada Sutta, the Buddha talks about many of his special qualities. So there's quite a few, but tonight we'll listen to just part that's related to the knowledges that he gained on the night of his enlightenment. So just to give a little bit of context, the sutta takes place at Vaisali. So we don't get a lot of suttas happening in Vaisali. Vaisali is north of Rajagaha, across the Ganges River. And it was a confederation of different tribes. They didn't have a single monarch. It was more of a republic, I guess. So the Lichavis were one of these groups. So the Buddha was living there, and on that occasion, Sunakata, son of the Lichavis, had recently left this Dhamma and discipline. He was making this statement before the Vaisali assembly. So he was a monk under the Buddha, and then he gave up the training. He left the monkhood. So he was making this statement before the Vaisali assembly. The recluse Gotama does not have any superhuman states, any distinction in knowledge and vision worthy of the noble ones. So he says that the Buddha didn't develop psychic powers. He didn't develop real perceptive knowledge of the world. He says, the recluse Gotama teaches a Dhamma, so a teaching, merely hammered out by reasoning, following his own line of inquiry as it occurs to him. So this is, it may sound like it's an okay thing to hammer something out by reason, following your own line of inquiry, but this is very distinct from what happened with the Buddha, that he wasn't just sort of saying, well, because of this, this is probably true, this makes sense, so that would have to make sense, and because of that, we can kind of figure out this, right? That's how we figure things out. We see what we can, we make some guesses, and we go with that. But that's very different than what the Buddha claimed to have done. That instead, he said that he actually saw the true nature of reality. He saw the arising and passing away of all conditioned phenomenon, and he saw directly how it is that we suffer because of the clinging that we have to these impermanent things. And then the final criticism, he says, and when he teaches that Dhamma to anyone, it leads him, when he practices it, to the complete destruction of suffering. So when the Buddha goes on to analyze this critique, he says, well, the first things are not true, right? It's not true that I don't have special knowledge. It's not true that the things that I taught, I just sort of worked out by figuring things out, logically reasoning things. He said those criticisms are not true. But this last one, this foolish guy, he's actually praising me, right? Saying that that someone who follows my teachings will put an end to suffering. So maybe he was saying that because this wasn't the goal of all spiritual teachings, right? That there was a variety of goals, and that the ending of suffering was just one of many goals that spiritual people at the time had. Some spiritual teachings were to reunite you with God or with a universal self, all kinds of different ideas. But the Buddha says that this last criticism, it's actually a compliment, right? It's actually, he's praising me, saying that the things that I teach lead someone who practices them to the end of suffering. So in this discourse, he talks about the special qualities that he has. And it's important for us to learn these qualities for a variety of reasons, because we're going to be reading things, we're going to be learning about things that we can't see for ourselves, that we can't sort of logically come to a conclusion because of the things that we observe. Buddhists have confidence in the Buddha and his enlightenment. They have confidence that the instructions that he gives leads to the ending of suffering. Even though at first the instructions may not seem, they may not seem correct, right? Because the Buddha teaches us that the ordinary things that we get happiness from, it's not a real, true kind of happiness. And so if we say, and monks said this, when the Buddha said, for example, you need to give up eating in the afternoon. Monks said, you know, we enjoy eating in the afternoon. That brings us happiness. Why should we give up that happiness on this wager that, you know, following your instructions are going to lead us to a greater happiness, right? We can see this happiness right now. Let's just go with that, eh? Right? So in order to practice these difficult teachings, these teachings of renunciation, these teachings that in so many ways go against society, we have to have confidence in him. As well, the Buddha taught that we can do a type of meditation. We haven't taught that here very much because it requires someone to have knowledge of the Buddha, someone to have confidence in the Buddha. But the Buddha actually taught that we can do a kind of meditation on the qualities of the Buddha. It's called Buddhanusati. So it's recollection of the Buddha. And it's similar in a way to loving kindness meditation, in that we have a thought that we're working with instead of just a single point of concentration. So when we read sermons like this, when we learn about these things, it enables us to practice this other kind of meditation that, for someone who has confidence in the Buddha, can strengthen that confidence, and it can make the mind very calm and peaceful. Because when we truly believe that we've come in contact with a teacher that can teach us things that lead to the end of suffering, well, that's really good news, right? And so when we're faced with the difficulties of the practice, when we're faced with setbacks, grounding ourselves in that recollection of the Buddha can be very, very powerful. So in this section of the sutta, the Buddha talks about the five destinations. So this is something that we see throughout his instructions, that he talks about samsara. So samsara is the Pali word for the cycle of rebirths. There's not really an English equivalent. So we just say the cycle of rebirths, or the round of rebirths. And this is what the Buddha is talking about when he talks about enlightenment, that it's a freedom from this cycle of rebirths. That as long as we have greed, hatred, and delusion, these deep-seated roots, then when we pass away from this life, we're reborn somewhere else. Maybe good, maybe bad. In particular, we're born in those places because of the actions that we've done or that we haven't done. So do we remember these three knowledges that the Buddha gain on the night of his enlightenment? First knowledge?
Past life recollection?
Yes, remembering his own past lives. So this first knowledge happened through the power of remembering, similar to the way that we remember things, except much, much deeper, things that we don't have any possibility of remembering. So this was the power of the purity of his mind, that he could remember previous lives. Some people do, and some children do. It's more common in children before they reach about six or seven, that they remember these past lives. Not terribly common, but we do see it happen. So then the second knowledge that he gained on the night of his enlightenment? The divine eye, yeah, which gave him the ability to see how beings are reborn according to their actions. So specifically, to see how karma works out beyond what we can see for ourselves in this life directly. And then the third knowledge of the Four Noble Truths and the destruction of all the defilements in the mind. So in this section, the Buddha makes this declaration that he understood the five destinations that beings can be reborn in. And so most of the time in the discourses, he talks about these five. We can subdivide a couple of them, but basically we can understand them to be five. So the Buddha is giving this discourse to the Venerable Sariputta. And so he says, Sariputta, there are these five destinations. What are the five? Hell, the animal realm, the realm of ghosts, human beings, and gods. So these are the five. First one, hell, the one nobody likes to think about. Second one,
animals.
Third one,
ghosts.
Fourth one,
God.
And heavenly beings. And this is the, when we have to line them all up, this is the order that the Buddha always lines them up in terms of horrible and really great. So he says, I understand hell and the path and the way leading to hell. I also understand how one who has entered this path will, on the dissolution of the body after death, reappear in a state of deprivation, in an unhappy destination, in perdition, in hell. So he understands not just these five destinations, but how it is that someone gets there. And not just in general how it is that someone gets there, but can actually see in individuals the things that they're doing and where that's going to lead them. So he says this for each of the five destinations. And then, most importantly, the good news, because this this seeing people's previous rebirths, that's actually a psychic power that other people developed. It's not exclusive to the Buddha. The understanding of karma is, but just the seeing of these destinations, even seeing that someone is reborn in a certain destination, that's an ability that someone with a very refined mind can have, separate from enlightenment. So then, most importantly, he says, I understand Nibbana and the path and the way leading to Nibbana. And I also understand how one who has entered this path will, by realizing for himself with direct knowledge, here and now, enter upon and abide in the deliverance of mind and deliverance by wisdom that are taintless with the destruction of the taints. So taints is a word for some very serious problems in the mind that keep us connected to this round of rebirth. We can also call them pollutions. Sometimes they're translated that way. So it's the pollution of sensual desire, the pollution of desire for existence at all, and the pollution of ignorance of Ijja. So then the Buddha goes on to give us some similes, and they're very telling similes, because most of us have never seen hell. We don't have any recollection of that. And so we're really just going on what the Buddha had to say about it. So he says, by encompassing mind with mind, so his mind encompassing the mind of someone else, I understand a certain person thus. This person so behaves, so conducts himself, has taken such a path that on the dissolution of the body, after death, he will reappear in a state of deprivation, in an unhappy destination, in perdition, in hell. And then later on, with the divine eye, which is purified and surpasses the human, I see that on the dissolution of the body, after death, he has reappeared in a state of deprivation, in an unhappy destination, in perdition, in hell, and is experiencing exclusively painful, racking, piercing feelings. So, through the psychic power of being able to know the mind of another, he understands the karma that they're collecting. And using the divine eye, after they pass away, he can see, yes, they ended up where I thought they would. And in particular, he points out that in the hell realms, it's exclusively painful. So all the other realms have a mixture of pleasure and pain, except at the very far end of the spectrum, the other end, there are some heavenly realms that are purely happiness, exclusively pleasant feelings. But in the hell realms, just pain. Pain kind of beyond what one could imagine a being could endure and still continue to exist. But that's hell. The hell realms generally tend to last very, very long. Again, spans of time that are really incomprehensible to us. And the Buddha doesn't go into these details here in this sermon, but the kind of things that land us there So the Buddha talks about wholesome bodily action, wholesome verbal action, wholesome mental action. Unwholesome bodily action, unwholesome verbal action, unwholesome mental action. So in general, we can know that any of the unwholesome actions can lead to rebirth in hell. Killing, stealing, sexual misconduct, telling lies, harsh speech, useless speech, divisive speech, and then the three kinds of mental action, anger, aversion, greed, desire, and wrong view. So believing that there's no such thing as karma, believing that we don't have a special relationship, a special duty to our parents and relatives, the belief that enlightenment isn't possible, no one attains enlightenment, no one's ever attained enlightenment. So the Buddha says on various occasions how these unwholesome actions lead to rebirth in hell realms. So he gives a simile. He says, suppose there were a charcoal pit deeper than a man's height, full of glowing coals, without flame or smoke, and then a man scorched and exhausted by hot weather, weary, parched, and thirsty, came by a path going in one way only and directed to that same charcoal pit. Then a man with good sight, on seeing him, would say, this person so behaves, so conducts himself, has taken such a path that he will come to this same charcoal pit. And then later on, he sees that he has fallen into that charcoal pit and is experiencing exclusively painful, racking, piercing feelings. So if we fall into a burning charcoal pit, there's nothing pleasant about that, right? There's no relief. You can't sort of stand up and get out, like just stand above it because you're still standing in it. It's just painful. So the same is true of these various hell realms, that that there's no relief from the suffering, that there's no practicing of the Dhamma, there's no meditating, there's no practicing generosity because there's nothing there to give that's worth giving. Everything there is horrible. And so the Buddha says, this is the first destination that I could see, and see how people are reborn there. So then, the same as well for the animal realm. He says, I can see how someone acting in a certain way is headed for the animal realm. And that later on, after they pass away, I can see that indeed they were reborn there. So for the animal realm, the Buddha gives a different simile. He says, suppose there were a cesspit deeper than a man's height, full of filth, and then a man scorched and exhausted by hot weather, weary, parched, and thirsty, came by a path going in one way only and directed to that same cesspit. And just like before, a man with good sight on seeing him would say, this person so behaves that he will come to this same cesspit. And later on, he sees that he has fallen into that cesspit and is experiencing painful, racking, piercing feelings. So, painful, racking, piercing feelings, but not exclusively, right? The exclusive pain is reserved for hell. So we can see that. Nobody likes to fall into a pit of excrement, right? It's pretty unpleasant all around, but at least you can stand up and sort of wipe your eyes off and take a deep breath and be like, okay. May not be a nice breath that you take, but you can sort of stand up and you can get up out of it, and you're still covered with filth and everything, but at least you can stand up and take a breather. So in the same way, the animal world is one of the realms that's mostly disadvantage, mostly unpleasant, but has the possibility for happiness. So the animals that we tend to see seem kind of happy, they're kind of running around, maybe they're eating, right? Still their life is full of a lot of difficulty, right? Some animals spend, 90% of their waking day looking for food, right? That they have to collect, a little tiny thing like a bird. Like, think about how many insects a bird has to eat, right? Or how many little seeds, right? Always looking for food. And the time that you're not looking for food, you're trying to avoid being someone else's food, right? That many times your children as an animal get eaten right in front of you, right? Some animals even eat their own children. I was walking, we walk along the road, and for weeks we've seen ducks kind of gathering in the ditches along the road. It seems really nice, they fly away. But then, like a couple days ago, I was walking along, and somehow, I don't know what was going on for the duck, but it kind of like didn't get up off the ground, and it was kind of freaking out, and it flew right into the road, right in front of me. It was horrible. And then I walked a little bit further, and I saw on the other side of the road all these little baby ducks, right? Super cute. Like, you see little baby ducks, and super cute, but then I'm like, was that the mother trying to fly into, try to protect the baby ducks? And, the poor ducks, like, maybe they lost their mother. Like, it's a bad situation, right? But there is happiness, right? Sometimes everything works out for the duck, right? And sometimes animals, if they're cute and they hook up with the right human being, they can have, not this human being, some animals we even let into our own homes, right? Even sleep on our own beds, right? And those animals, right, their food is all looked after, they go to doctors that are better than most humans see, right? It's incredible. We have stores that are dedicated, right? Even there's a holistic vet in Winnipeg. I'm not criticizing, I'm saying how amazing it is that, right, even animals can experience, great happiness. So it's not exclusively painful, but still, it's not the goal. Like, it's not a good situation. There's really no practicing of the Dhamma. There's sort of marginal amounts of generosity that you can see animals practicing, but it's often not that great. Like, your cat, maybe it goes out and it kills a bird and it gives it to you, right? Sort of generosity, but killing, like, not very thoughtful, maybe. So minor amounts of generosity, not a lot, not really a good opportunity. And so with the animal world, the very same things that can lead you to hell can also land you in the animal world. Additionally, there are places where the Buddha mentions specifically sort of a lot of strong desire around food tends to lead to animal rebirth. He mentions that in a few different places. You're really attached to food, you could end up in a destination where you spent most of your time looking for food. So then the next, he talks about the ghost world, saying that he can see that someone's behaving in such a way that they'll be reborn in the ghost world. Afterwards, he sees that they are. And this is the simile that he gives. He says, suppose there were a tree growing on uneven ground with scanty foliage, casting a dappled shadow. And then a man scorched and exhausted by hot weather, weary, parched, and thirsty, came by a path going in one way only, directed to that same tree. And the person seeing him thinks he's headed to that tree. That's the only place that he'll get to. And then later on, he sees that this person is sitting or lying in the shade of that tree, experiencing much painful feeling. So we're hot and tired, walking along, and the best that we come to is this tree that barely provides shade, right? Maybe the shade of the trunk, branches a little bit, right? Still very uncomfortable. The person's still hot, still thirsty. It doesn't fix that problem. So this is sort of an upgrade from the cesspit. Pretty much everybody would choose the bare tree to sit under. So it's has more of an opportunity for comfort than the animal world, but still very unpleasant. So in other places, the Buddha talks about this life in the ghost world, that it's often very unpleasant, with some mixtures of relief, and sometimes even incredible happiness. So for the most part, though, it's not very nice. But we can see some ghosts experiencing happiness even similar to what heavenly beings experience. So, for example, there was a situation where there was a ghost whose body was very, very beautiful, but their mouth was really foul-smelling. They had a horrible mouth. And a monk saw this ghost. Most people can't see ghosts, by the way. You may have noticed. You might not have seen many ghosts. But some monks can. Some people have that ability. And it seems that some ghosts can sort of choose to make themselves appear. So a monk saw this ghost and said, "And this is a really weird situation. Your body will almost look like a god, but your mouth is horrible. I can smell it all the way over here." And so the ghost says, and the monk asks, because that's what a good monk does, is say, how did this happen? Like, what was the karma that you did? So if you run into a ghost, you can always think to ask that question. Whether or not you'll get an answer, I don't know, but at least it'll keep your mind focused. So this monk asks, you know, what is it that you, like, how did this happen? And the ghost says, "Yes, with my body, I did good things. I didn't break any precepts. I didn't kill. I didn't steal. I didn't commit sexual misconduct. But with my mouth, I did all kinds of terrible things. I lied. I had harsh speech. I broke up people's friendships. So see how terrible this karma is of using," the ghost says, "see how terrible this is. Don't say things. Don't do bad speech," right? Because it's very easy for us to think, "Oh, well, I didn't kill anybody. I don't steal things. You know, this speech problem, it's, you know, not so bad. It's not as bad as killing. It's not as bad as stealing." But it still gives results. It's still karma that we're collecting. So the largest collection of information that we have about ghosts is in a book called the Vimanavata. It's part of the fifth Nikaya, the Kuddhika Nikaya. And it's 70 or so stories about various ghosts. And we should have copies of it in the library you can check out. Very interesting. Just to see the variety of ways that karma can play out in both a mixed state as well as painful. So then the next destination is the human world. And again, he says, "I can see the path that leads there. I can see how people are reborn in the human world." And this, of course, is the world that we have the most personal experience with. So it's a little bit easier to understand. In the simile, he says, "Suppose there were a tree growing on even ground with thick foliage, casting a deep shade. And then a man scorched and exhausted by hot weather, weary, parched, and thirsty, came by a path going in one way. So he was headed that way and eventually could be seen sitting under this tree, experiencing much pleasant feelings. So we can all imagine traveling, especially here in Manitoba. You can end up walking in the sun, right? Because there's lots of grassland. And so we finally come to a tree and we sit in the shade, and it's a huge, huge relief. So this person, they're still thirsty. It's not a perfect situation, but they have this sense of relief. So in the same way, the human world, it's great potential for happiness, right? Much better than this mixed situation in the ghost world. So then the fifth destination is the heavenly realm. And again, the Buddha gives a simile for that. He says, suppose there were a mansion, and it had an upper chamber plastered within and without, shut off, secured by bars, with shuttered windows. And there was a couch spread with a rug, blankets and sheets, with a deerskin cover, with a canopy, as well as crimson pillows for both head and feet. So a palace. And then a man, scorched and exhausted by hot weather, weary, parched, and thirsty, came by a path going in one way only, and directed to that same mansion. So same situation. Later on, the person would see them sitting or lying down in the upper chamber of that mansion, experiencing exclusively pleasant feelings. So the lower heavenly realms are actually also a little mixed. It's still mostly nice, it's mostly great. But in the lower heavenly realms, especially those that are more tightly associated with the earth, there's the possibility for harm, and there's a whole class of non-human beings that are always at war with another group of non-human beings. So in the lower realms, a little bit of unpleasantness. And certainly passing away from the heavenly realms is unpleasant. But especially in the higher heavenly realms, exclusively pleasant. No pain from the material kinds of suffering that we have. The biggest suffering comes when they have to pass away from those heavenly realms. So just like in the human world, if we get attached to these pleasures, when the pleasures change, then we have to suffer, we have to experience the pain. So then, the most important thing, because if the Buddha just pointed out these different destinations but didn't give us a fix, then we wouldn't be any better off, or we wouldn't be much better off. So for the human world and the heavenly worlds, the Buddha talks in terms of how to get there, the 10 kinds of wholesome action. So abstaining from killing, protecting living beings, abstaining from stealing, right? Being generous, protecting other people's property, abstaining from sexual misconduct, abstaining from lies, harsh speech, slander, gossip, giving up anger, giving up greed, giving up wrong views. That these are all actions that lead to the human world or even to the heavenly world. And specifically, that strong acts of generosity lead to even greater happiness in these worlds. So even in the heavenly worlds, the Buddha said you can see distinctions between heavenly beings that practiced a lot of generosity in the past and ones that practiced less generosity. And those ones that did more have even more happiness. So then the Buddha talks about this sixth possibility, because that's the one that matters most. and that's enlightenment. So he says, again, I can see that someone is practicing in the right way. They're following the path that leads to enlightenment. And that later on, he can see for himself that they attain enlightenment. So again, the Buddha gives a simile. He says, suppose there were a pond with clean, agreeable, cool water, transparent, with smooth banks, delightful, and nearby a dense wood, and then a man scorched and exhausted by hot weather, weary, parched, and thirsty, came by a path going in one way only, towards that same pond. And then a man with good sight on seeing him would say, this person behaves so that he will come to this same pond. And then, later on, he sees that he is plunged into the pond, bathed, drunk, and relieved all his distress, fatigue, and fever, and has come out again, and is sitting or lying in the wood, experiencing exclusively pleasant feelings. So the Buddha said, this is a simile for Nibbana, right? We see it's this very beautiful natural situation, right? It's not like the mansion, that's more of a human construction, but it's this situation that brings total relief. He gets to drink, he gets to take a bath, and afterwards he sits in a very peaceful place, enjoying the shade. So the Buddha says, this is what we really want to reach for, right? That all the things that we do headed in that direction, they all lead us to at least a good destination, right? Even if it doesn't lead us all the way to enlightenment, it leads us, at the very least, to the human world or to the heavenly worlds, both places that we can continue to practice the teachings. But the most important thing is to be trying to reach this sixth possibility, because even in the human world, even in the heavenly world, it's temporary. The only time that even beings who attain stages of enlightenment, right, can take rebirth in these two destinations. So when we understand these different destinations, when we understand the types of actions in general that lead to these different destinations, when we add that to the other teachings that we've learned from the Buddha on karma and how it ripens, right? Because here the Buddha's talking specifically about karma when it ripens as a destination, right? But as well, karma ripens to give us all kinds of different experiences in these different destinations, right? Once we're there. And we can remember the simile that we learned last week. Remember those similes of the salt crystal, right, in the river versus a salt crystal in a small glass of water, right? That wherever we're reborn, we want to make sure that we have a mind that's as broad as possible, right? So that when these things ripen, that we'll experience the least pain possible and the most happiness from the good actions. So this is just a small part of this Mahasihanada Sutta. This is also one of the discourses where we get a lot of information about the Buddha's practice towards enlightenment, so the austerities that he practiced. We also find those in this sutta. So this evening we've had the chance to learn these six very beautiful similes. The simile, let's see, do we remember them? First simile was for hell, and it was the charcoal pit, burning pit. And then the simile for the animal world, cesspit, yeah. And for the ghost world, tree without much shade. And for the human world, nice tree with shade. Heavenly world, the mansion. And Nibbana?
Pond.
Yeah, the pond near the forest. So having learned these teachings, having learned these very beautiful similes, having developed our knowledge of the Buddha and his enlightenment, may we reflect wisely on these teachings. May we put these teachings into practice. May we one day experience for ourselves this cool relief of Nibbana in this Gautama Buddha's dispensation. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.